Very good. Genesis chapter 12. This is obviously on the heels of last week's story about Noah and about the Tower of Babel and the way the Lord confused the languages of man. And in last week's portion, it's not something we discussed, but we learn a little bit about what is referred to sometimes as the Table of Nations, the nations that existed in these days during the time of Abraham. And in the beginning of this portion, after all is said and done, after the Lord destroys the earth with a flood, and the earth is repopulated, and mankind spreads out once again over the earth, the Lord speaks to Avram in verse 1 of chapter 12 and says to him, "Leave your country, your people, and your father's household, and go to the land that I will show you." Notice that the text doesn't explain who Avram is, doesn't explain why he was chosen, doesn't explain his calling, doesn't introduce us to him, really, in any meaningful way. We know virtually nothing about Avram. And the Lord says to him, while he's in Ur of the Chaldees, "Leave your country, your people, and your father's household, and go to the land that I will show you." And in verse 2, he makes him a tremendous promise. "I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all of the peoples on earth will be blessed through you." Seven elements, right? Seven elements to the promise that God makes here to Avram. And what's remarkable about it is that this promise is something that God intends to accomplish not only in Avram's life, but in the lives of his descendants too, because his descendants are included in many of these promises, right? The idea that God will make Avram into a great nation. Well, obviously, a great nation requires people, requires descendants, right? God says to him, "I will bless you." And we've discussed before regarding the fact that blessing in Hebrew typically involves physical blessing, physical prosperity, but obviously it also implies a spiritual work as well. God says that he will make Avram's name great, which is not to say that he will put Avram's name in lights. That's not what is being said here. Okay? God is not saying, "Avram, I am going to make you famous so that people from all over the world will walk up to you and ask for your autograph. Your name will be known." That's not the idea. The idea is that he will make his character great, his reputation great, his relationship with God great. That's what this idiom means. "I will make your name great. And you will also be a blessing to others. Not only will I bless you," God says, "but I will use you to bless others." Right? So in the same way that I bless you, I will use you to bless others. And this is an important idea because it obviously means, by definition, that the ways in which God blesses us, whether it's with financial prosperity or with wisdom or with skills, various skills, whether it's with compassion, whether it's with administrative abilities, regardless of the way God blesses us, he wants us to use those abilities, those talents, those gifts in order to bless others, right? Something else he says in verse 3, "I will bless those who bless you." So God will hold others accountable for the way they treat Abraham in either the blessing and, of course, the curse. So God says to Avram that those who bless you, those who receive you, those who embrace you, I will bless those too. I will bless them as well. And those who curse you, God says, I will curse them. Right? So in other words, people will experience from the Lord whatever they express on behalf of Avram and his descendants. That's an important idea too, obviously. And then he goes on to say, all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. And obviously, this is picked up by apostolic authors to apply primarily, although not exclusively, but to apply primarily to the coming of the Messiah. So this is seen as a promise regarding the Messiah who will come and deliver all people, right? Who will provide a way for all men to call upon the name of the Lord and to be saved. Okay? So this sevenfold promise to Avram is quite remarkable. It's unprecedented in the Scriptures. There is nothing in the Scriptures even remotely like this sevenfold promise in anything that is said prior to this time. And at this point, we are a little baffled as to why Avram is the one chosen to be the progenitor of a great people. Okay? In verse 4, Avram left, and perhaps this is part of the reason. And this is an incredibly important phrase. God says to Abraham, leave your country. And what does Avram do in verse 4? He left. He goes. He obeys. He understood clearly what the Lord called him to, and he does exactly what the Lord instructs him to do. But you have to think of what Avram is being asked to leave. His people, his father's household, and his country. Right? I rearranged the order a little bit, but there are three things that Avram was required to leave. His country, his people, and his father's household. Now, I don't know if you've ever given any thought to how difficult this would be for Avram. To leave the country of his birth, right? To leave his people. Not only the country of his birth and the country in which he was raised and the country that he must have had some loyalty to, right? That kind of ethnic loyalty, of course, is the basis for nationalism, the kind of nationalism that exists today and divides one people from another, right? So for better or for worse, nationalism is a strong influence upon us. And he's told to leave his people, his culture, and his father's household, even his own father's household, the connection he has to parents and grandparents. An incredibly, incredibly difficult thing to do. And it doesn't even say in the text that Abraham had to pray about it. Lord, give me a minute. Lord, thank you. Wow. Pretty amazing stuff. Let me pray about it. We don't have any idea what takes place in Abraham's or Avram's, at this point, his heart. And the text, Moses doesn't seem particularly concerned about communicating that aspect of Avram's decision. It just says he left. as the Lord had told him, and it says that Lot went with him. Notice something else that's interesting. Avram is 75 years old when he set out for Haran. 75. His call comes to him when, you know, when he's older, right? When he's seasoned. I mean, for us, 75 is towards the end of a person's life. Obviously, in Avram's case, he was about middle age, right? Which would put him at about our 40. And it's interesting because we think of the kind of effort that goes into a relationship with God, and very few of us think of getting a start at this whole thing as late in life as the age of 40, right? But, of course, for Avram, it was perfect, apparently. At any rate, he took his wife Sarai, his nephew Lot, and all the possessions they had accumulated, and notice, and all the people they had acquired in Haran. And they set out for the land of Canaan, and they arrived there. And in verse 6 it says, Avram traveled through the land as far as the site of the great tree of Moreh at Shechem, or Shechem. At that time the Canaanites were in the land, and the Lord appeared to Avram and said, to your offspring I will give this land. Right? When did the Lord appear to Avram? Before he left Ur, or after he got to Canaan? If you look back at verse 1, it just says that the Lord spoke to him. The Hebrew word is the word that we use for just regular conversation, right? The kind of conversation where two people speak with one another. God's appearance doesn't occur until verse 7. The Lord appeared to Avram. It's not explained. And to Avram, he says, to your offspring I will give this land. Obviously, the promise of a great nation included offspring, and God says he's going to give Avram's descendants this land. So he built an altar there to the Lord who had appeared to him, and from there he went on towards the hills east of Beit El and pitched his tent. With Beit El on the west and Ai on the east, there he built an altar to the Lord, and notice it says that he called on the name of the Lord. What did he do? Right, we'll talk about that in a few minutes. Then Abraham or Avram set out and continued towards the Negev. Now, if you look at your notes, I want to read from a commentary on this portion. A very insightful commentary, and we'll talk about a few of the details, okay? A sizable portion of the book of Genesis is devoted to the life of Abraham. Most curiously, however, we meet Abraham, or first meet Abraham, rather late in his celebrated life. The first event of Abraham's life described in detail by the Torah occurred when he is 75 years old. So we know very little about him prior to this time. Okay? Now, going back to verse 1, I want to talk a little bit about the word leave. Okay? The Lord had said to Avram, leave. By that time, Abraham was able to look back upon a lifetime of faithful, indeed unprecedented, achievement. As a young child, his inquisitive mind discerned a greater truth implicit in the workings of the universe, and he came to know the one true God. Now notice, there is nothing actually said in the text about this, right? This is something that is the subject of a great deal of speculation by the rabbis. But the Lubavitcher Rebbe puts it this way. He was a lone man, pitted against the entire world. He battled the entrenched pagan perversity of his time, bringing many to a life of monotheistic belief and morality. Now, there's a wonderful story in the Midrash told about Avraham and about his experiences in Ur with his family, his father and his brothers, right? It's from the Midrash, Seder Eliyahu Rabbah, and I have this Midrash for you in your notes. It says, Abraham's family used to make images and sell them in the market. One day when it was Abraham's turn to sell, his father Terah gave him several baskets of household gods and set him up in the marketplace. A man came to him and asked, "Have you a god to sell?" Abraham responded, "What kind of a god do you wish to buy?" The man said, "I am a mighty man. Give me a god as mighty as I am." So Abraham took an image that was standing on a shelf, higher than all of the others, and said, "Pay the money and take this one." The man asked, "Is this God as mighty as I am?" And Abraham replied, and listen to this reply, "You good for nothing, don't you know the way of gods? The one who sits above all others is the mightiest of all." As the man was about to leave, Abraham asked him, "How old are you?" The man answered, 70 years. And Abraham says, "Woe to a man who is 70, yet prostrates himself before this thing which was made only today." At that, the man flung the god back into Abraham's basket, demanded the return of his money, and went his way. Okay? Next, the story goes on to say, a widow came who said to Abraham, "I am a poor woman. Give me a god as poor as I am." At once Abraham took an image that was on a shelf lower than all of the others and said, "To suit your poverty, take this god who is humble, placed as he is on a shelf below all of the others. But he will not budge until you pay me the money." So she paid the price. And as she was about to depart, he asked her, "How old are you?" She replied, "Quite old." Abraham then said, "May the breath of such a woman be blasted. To think that one so old prostrates herself before a god who is only one day old." She immediately dropped the god into the basket, got back her money from Abraham, and went her way. Right? What happens? Abraham takes all of the gods and he takes them back to his father Terah. Terah's other sons said to their father, "This Abraham does not know how to sell gods. Come then, and let us make him a priest." Abraham asked, "What is a priest's work?" They replied, "He waits upon the gods, offers sacrifices to them, and serves them food and drink." So they made him a priest. Abraham promptly set food and drink before the images and said to them, "Come and eat, come and drink, so that you may be able to bestow good upon human beings." But not one of them took anything at all to eat or drink. Then Abraham began to recite the verse, "They have mouths, but they speak not, eyes they have, but they see not, they have ears, but they hear not, noses have they, but they smell not, they have hands, but they handle not, feet they have, but they walk not." A quote from Psalm 115, verses 5 through 7, that was written by King David 1,000 years later. Part of the reason why I'm reading this story is because I want you to appreciate the significance of Midrash. This Midrash is designed to help us appreciate the meaning of Avram's call. What Avram experienced in Ur. The way he turned away from the perverse paganism which characterized the culture of Ur and turns to the one true God in the midst of it. Now, the text doesn't give us any information about how difficult a process that must have been. But the Midrash does fill in some of this detail and does help us to appreciate the story of Avram, frankly, in a way that it is simply not possible to appreciate otherwise. Now, the story goes on to say, a woman carrying a bowl of fine flour and said, here, offer it to the gods. So a woman brought Avram a bowl of fine flour, and because he was a priest, he was asked to offer this bowl of fine flour to the gods. At that, Abraham seized a stick, smashed all the images, and placed the stick in the hand of the biggest of them. When his father came, he asked, who did this to all the gods? And Abraham answered, would I hide anything from my father? A woman came with a bowl of fine flour and said, here, offer it up to them. When I offered it, one god said, I will eat first. And another said, no, I will eat first. Then the biggest of them rose up and smashed all the others. His father replied, are you making sport of me? They cannot do anything. And Abraham answered, you say they cannot. Let your ears hear what your mouth is saying. Okay? Let your ears hear what your mouth is saying. In other words, even though Terah knew that the idols were nothing, he continued to profit by them. He continued to sell them, and he continued to encourage others to worship them. Even though he himself knew that those images were simply the product of his own efforts. Okay? Now, in all fairness, it could be said, as is often said of idols, well, come on. Everybody knows that an idol is nothing, that an idol is only a representation of the god, right? I mean, who prays to idols? Nobody prays to idols. People pray to the people or to the saints or to the gods that the idols represent. But of course, we're going to find that in the scriptures, God prohibits the making of an idol or putting anything in God's place, right? And based upon nothing more than this story, I think it's possible to appreciate just how great an abomination the perversion of paganism is to God. Now, we of course move on from this story to address many of the texts in other portions of the Torah. And by the way, in the prophets and in the apostolic writings as well, in which it speaks of the abhorrence with which God expresses towards idolatry. I mean, idolatry is a very, very serious condition. It's a condition which not so much these days, but certainly in biblical times, characterized the lives of the Gentiles. Right? And here God raises up a man to be the father of a nation, to be a light to these Gentiles who worship the creature, rather than the Creator who is blessed forever. Amen. Right? And of course, Paul in his letter to the Romans addresses this question. He addresses this whole issue and says that all men are without excuse, even the Gentiles, who have not yet heard the preaching of the gospel, even they have willingly and knowingly and deliberately exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshipped the creature rather than the Creator. Because according to what Paul says in Romans, according to what David says in the Psalms, according to what Moses says in Genesis, the creation of the universe is such a breathtaking thing that it should speak to us about the nature and the character of the one God who designed and created it all, as opposed to worshiping aspects of the created universe, right? There is an expectation in the Scriptures that we worship the God who created it all. You understand? It's an incredibly, incredibly important idea. By the way, there's an alternative ending to this story, which is very similar. And of course, it's based upon the same Midrash, but this story appears in other sources as well. And it says, one night Abraham smashed all of his father's idols. The next morning his father, incensed, demanded to know who had destroyed his property. They attacked each other, Abraham told him. That's impossible, cried Terach. They are made of stone. There is no soul or spirit in them. Why do you worship them? Abraham challenged. Why do you worship them? Now, I mentioned when we started this cycle that we would be talking about some of the moral and ethical implications of some of the stories that we would read. If you're interested in an overview of this passage or this portion, or if you're interested in specific details about other aspects of this portion, then please go to our website and download some of the previous studies that I have done on this section. But we're not doing that this year. I want to talk about specific aspects of these portions. And another Midrash that comes up in connection with this portion has to do with what it says about the people that Avram acquired in Haran, right? We just read in verse 5 that the souls that they had made in Haran, that when Abraham leaves Ur, he takes with him Sarai, his wife, Lot, his nephew, his possessions, and all of the souls that they had made in Haran. What does that mean? This verse implies, according to the Midrash, you can look at your notes, the great Midrash on the book of Genesis, our father Abraham would bring people into his home, give them food and drink, befriend them, and thus attract them, and then convert them. Convert them to what? Convert them to God. Obviously, the implication here is that they are converted to Judaism, even though Judaism doesn't really exist yet. Right? We think of Avram as the first Jew, even though technically the term Jew comes from the tribe of Judah, right? A Jew, at least, right? during the time of Moses, was a Judahite, a member of the tribe of Judah. But notice that in Jewish literature, we don't really use the term that way. We don't define it that technically. A Jew is a descendant of Abraham, a person connected to the promise that God made to Abraham. Obviously, the promise that God reiterated to Isaac, the promise that God reiterated to Jacob, and the promise that God reiterated to Jacob's 12 sons. Right? Those are Jews. Those who are the physical descendants of one of Jacob's 12 sons. But here it says that Avram converted these people, and he brought them under the wings of the presence. Notice an evasive synonym for God. The wings of the presence. Hence you learn that a man who brings a single creature under the wings of the presence is accounted as if he had created him, shaped him, and articulated his parts. So, what are the two aspects of Abraham's character that we discover in these stories about Avram in his leaving Ur and responding to God's command? Number one, Avram hated paganism as much as God did. He hated falsehood. He hated lies. He hated anything that interfered with a person's ability to come to know the one true God, which, not only according to this Midrash, but according to what the Bible says in the rest of it, attests to the fact that idolatry interferes in our relationship with God, regardless of the extent to which it is woven into the fabric of the way our cultures celebrate events. Do you understand? Avram was a man who had a heart for God, but he had a passion for the things of God. He had a passion for truth. He had a passion for people, right? Which is also evident about Abraham is his compassion, his hospitality, the heart that he has to reach out to people, all people, people who are entangled in idolatrous behavior, right? The people that he meets in Ur, he invites them to his home. He makes them feel welcome. He brings them in. In other words, Avram is a person who reaches out to people and connects them, makes them part of his family. And in the process, introduces them to God and sees them turned to the Holy One, the God of the universe, the creator of the heaven and the earth. Right? So, with that, let's continue reading. But then came an event of such significance that it eclipses the first 7.5 decades of Abraham's life, an event that marked the forging of a new phenomenon, the Jew, and redefined the journey of life. The event was God's call to Abraham, go to you from your land, from your birthplace, and from your father's house to the land that I will show you. Now that you have realized the full capacity of your conscious powers, go on to you. Do you see it highlighted in the text? I will show you a place that is the essence of your own self, a place that lies beyond the land, birthplace, and father's house that you know. Okay? Now, what we're about to talk about is this idea, Lech Lecha, which is what the portion is called in Hebrew. And you can see it in your notes. Lech Lecha. Okay? The first word, Lech, is a masculine singular imperative to Avram to go, right? Go with 100 exclamation points, right? It's a forceful command to Avram to go. But the lecha part means for yourself, even though it's typically translated, go forth, it actually literally says, go for yourself, right? It's an important distinction, because on the one hand, we have God calling Avram to leave Ur so that he might father a people that is connected to him, right? So he is going, not just for himself, but he's going that the Lord might use him to accomplish his purpose and to create a nation who will be a light to the Gentiles. But in his going, he is also going for himself too. And that's incredibly important for us to appreciate. This expression, go for yourself, the Rebbe goes on to say, the call to separate oneself, excuse me, this is a different commentary, a Rabbi Eli Monk, go for yourself, the call to separate oneself from homeland, birthplace, and father's house constituted the first steps towards Judaism. Listen to this. To be a Jew means to break with the crowd out of love for God and to accept the sacrifice of isolation. You want an ethical or moral lesson from the text? It's hard to imagine a better one. The ethical value of the principle of isolation has been brought out by Rabbi Bachya ibn Pakuda, author of Chavos Halevavos, Duties of the Heart, in a piece he wrote, in which he says the divine command, Lech Lecha, go for yourself, is put at the head of Judaism. It implies the will to go it alone with God, if need be. The idea of majority rule is indeed legitimate, and it's valuable in terms of a political process, but not in terms of our relationship with God, right? But when the majority's values do not meet the criterion of divine truth, man has the duty to separate himself and to remain alone for himself with his God. How could we have existed, and how could we, speaking of the Jewish people, have continued to exist if Avram had not given us the courage to be a minority? Right? In other words, God has called the Jewish people to a unique obligation and responsibility. And just like for Abraham, it sometimes means for us that we must go it alone. Right? It's a wonderful blessing when it is possible for us to go it alone in partnerships with others, in partnership with a husband, with a wife, with children, with family, with a community. But the fact of the matter is, that is not always possible. It is simply not always possible, right? And the reason why this is such an important idea is because it's an idea that's embedded into the kishkes, into the hearts of the Jewish people, and has been for a very, very long time, right? Much of their strength and tenacity and ability to persevere has come from all of the hardships that the Jewish people have been required to endure for centuries, right? But there is something about the passion that drives a people that is important too. Like the zeal of Pinchas, like the zeal of a Paul, the zeal of an Avram, the zeal of a Moshe, a zeal of an Aaron, a zeal of a Sarah, a Rebecca, a Rachel, an Esther, a Ruth, right? A Tamar. I mean, these people's lives were characterized by a passion, a heart for God, that drove them to accomplish and to do and to be the kind of person that God called them to be, right? And it's important because, in the words of Yeshua, this idea is communicated too. In John 17, for example, Yeshua, in his prayer to the Father, says, "I have given them your word, but the world has hated them." Why? "Because they are not of this world any more than I am of the world." And ironically, Yeshua prays in verse 15, "My prayer is not that you take them out of the world, but that you protect them from the evil one." Why would his disciples be hated? Right? Because they are not of this world. Right? By the way, he says they would be hated by the world, not hated by the Jewish people. They are not the same thing, obviously. The world, the cosmos, in this Greek text, speaks of the world order, the world system. A world system whose master is Hasatan, right? The ruler of this world, the ruler of this age. And by the way, his primary effort is directed at turning people away from God. And how does he do that? Read the parable of the four soils, right? What happens to people who hear God's word? Right? There are so many things that we let interfere with what we've been called to do, with a relationship with God, right? We let our country, our people, and our Father's house, right? We let our culture and what we know, we let our previous training, our previous theology, our previous doctrine to interfere with what the text says and calls us to, right? The fact of the matter is that the Lord has not called us to be separate from the world. He has called us to be a testimony in the world to those who are blinded and need to see. By the way, that expression is used of both Jews and Gentiles in the Scripture. It's used of anyone who has turned away from God, right? That's not unique to any specific people group, right? The fact is in Paul's letter to the Corinthians, he says that we're supposed to be on our guard, to stand firm in the faith, be courageous, be strong, right? Do everything in love. But the point is that walking with God requires a strength, requires a passion, requires a commitment to truth that is simply not true of the faith of those that has become interwoven and interconnected to idolatry and paganism. Right? The fact of the matter is, the Lord has called us to be separate and distinct from it. This expression, your country, your people, and your Father's household, this is a beautiful comment too. The countless factors involved in making us what we are can be generalized under three categories: the natural, the impressed, and the acquired. We begin life already programmed with the drives and inclinations that form an inborn psyche and character. Then begins, from the moment of birth, the influence of our environment as parents, teachers, and peers impress their manners and attitudes upon our souls. Finally, a third and overriding influence comes with the attainment of intellectual maturity. Man alone, among God's creatures, has been granted an objective intellect with which he can, to a great extent, control the stimuli to which he is exposed and the manner in which they shall affect him. With his mind, he is empowered to develop himself beyond and even contrary to his genetic and conditioned self. This is the deeper significance of the words, your land, your birthplace, and your father's house. In God's call to Abraham or to Avram, edits. Right? You're familiar with the word edits. Edits Yisrael, the land of Israel, right? But the word edits, the Hebrew word for land and earth, is etymologically related to the word ratzon, the Hebrew word for will and desire. So your land also translates as your natural desires. Your birthplace, moladecha, is a reference to the influence of home and society. And Beit Avicha, your father's house, refers to man as a mature and rational being, forging his mindset, character, and behavior with the transcendent objectivity of the intellect. By conventional standards, this constitutes the ultimate in human achievement, the development of one's natural instincts, the assimilation of learned and observed truths, and the remaking of self through the objective arbiter of mind. In truth, however, the intellect is still part and parcel of our humanity, remaining ever subject to the deficiencies and limitations of the human state. While it may surmount the confines of the inborn and the impressed, ultimately, the intellect is never truly free of the ego and its prejudices. But there is a higher self to man, a self free of all that defines and confines the human, the divine essence that God breathed into him, the image of God in which he was created, the edits that God promised to show Avram. Not just the land, but a will with a heart to know and to desire God. Right? So in his journey of discovery, Abraham must obviously depart the land, birthplace, and father's house of his native Mesopotamia. He must objectively reject the pagan culture of Ur, Chasdim, and Haran. But this is not the departure of which we are speaking in the above quoted verse. For Abraham received this call many years after he renounced the pagan ways of his family and birthplace, recognizing God and had a profound impact on his society. Still, he is told to go. Depart from your nature. Depart from your habits. Depart from your rational self. After rejecting your negative, idolatrous origins, you must now also transcend your positive and gainful past and reach beyond yourself. What does this mean for us? Unless for some reason you assume that Avram's call to Abraham only applied to Abraham, right? Are we called to something similar? Are we called to turn away from our land, our people, and our Father's house, if that is what is required to know God, right? This is a tough choice for many of us. And frankly, it was a very, very difficult choice for Gentiles living in the first century, right? I've expressed this irony many times. It's ironic that it is often difficult to communicate with Jewish people about Yeshua. In the first century, that was something which was easy to do, right? Very simple, to talk with Jewish people about Yeshua, because Yeshua is the Jewish Messiah, right? So it's possible to communicate to them using the same ideas, the same cultural framework, the same language, the same worldview. Gentiles, on the other hand, had a very difficult time in the first century. And there are other biblical examples, too. Talk about Naaman the leper. Do you remember him? A Gentile who comes to Elisha to be healed of his leprosy. What cultural obstacles did he have to overcome in order to embrace the one true God? And what about Ruth, who was taken in and made a part of the family of Naomi in the same way these proselytes in the book of Genesis were taken in and made a part of the family of Abraham, right? In the first century, it was hard for Gentiles to embrace the Messiah, because Gentiles in the first century had no idea. They did not have in their culture a concept of a Messiah, a concept of someone who would suffer and die for sins, right? A concept of someone who would save, a concept of someone who would connect them to the one true God as opposed to many gods, right? We think of Greek mythology just as that, as mythology. But of course, they didn't think of it as mythology. It was paganism, a belief in many gods, and a belief in many gods that spawned the cultural and ethnic practices that are still so true of pagan culture today, right? In the first century, when a Gentile embraced Yeshua as the Messiah, he turned away from his land. He turned away from his people. And he turned away from his father's house. And he embraced the Messiah. And he embraced God. He embraced Israel. He became connected to the people of Israel. Right? Doesn't Yeshua himself say that anyone who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me? Anyone who loves their son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me? Now, obviously, it doesn't always require that we sacrifice mother and father and son or daughter. Right? But there are times when it does. And Yeshua is simply saying in a very expressive, idiomatic way that we must put God first in our lives. That doesn't mean that we ignore our loved ones, that we ignore the people that we're connected to, unless, of course, those connections interfere, challenge, compromise who we are and what God has called us to. Right? By the way, Paul expresses in his letter to the Ephesians exactly what I just expressed. Right? He talks to the Ephesians in chapter 2 and says to them, "You were dead in your trespasses and sins." Right? "You followed the ways of this world and of the ruler of the kingdom of the air, the spirit who is now at work in those who are disobedient." Right? But he says that in the Messiah, those who were once far off have been brought near, right? And he goes on to tell them in chapter 2 that they are no longer foreigners, no longer strangers. They have been connected to God and to God's people, Israel. Right? They were strangers and foreigners from the promises and the covenants that God made with the Jewish people. And in the Messiah, they are connected to these things. Connected to God. But connected to God in the Messiah. In Israel. They're adopted into the family. Just like these proselytes in the time of Abraham. And just like Ruth. They became a part of God's people. Are there any implications for us today? I mean, my goodness. Are there any implications for those of you who are Gentiles and have been called to be connected to God's people? What does that mean? Right? And by the way, it's obviously easy for me to talk about it and not so easy to put it into play. It isn't easy for anyone to put into play. Right? So what? What does that have to do with anything? Right? Was it easy for Avram to leave his land, his people, and his father's house? No, I would think it wasn't an easy thing for him to do. Right? Did Abraham have an easy life? No, he didn't. He had a very difficult, trying life. The only thing that we can say about Avram is that when he left Ur, he left in faith because he trusted God. Right? If you look at Hebrews chapter 11, by faith Abraham, when called to go to a place he would later receive as an inheritance, he obeyed and went. By faith he made his home in the promised land. By faith he lived like a stranger in a foreign country. He lived in tents. Do you know something? As much as we are connected to this place, and as beautiful as this place is, we are always supposed to think of ourselves as people sojourning here. Right? Passing through. Well, when people pass through, they tend not to put down deep roots. Right? I mean, why? Does that mean that we shouldn't live comfortably? No. Not necessarily. I am talking more about an attitude of the heart. Right? Abraham had great possessions. Was he attached to them? No. God said that through Abraham, others would be blessed. And so what does Abraham do? He takes the resources that God gives him and he gives them to others. Abraham was a funnel. Right? We should think of ourselves as funnels too. Right? With a whole host in a whole host of practical ways. Right? This idea is such an important one and is probably one of the most significant lessons that it is possible for one to learn from this portion, right? This notion, this idea of being called, being connected to a people, right? Being connected to the Jewish people is not just a simple, sweet, theological notion. It includes practical aspects. Right? It means for us as a community that we reorient our week around the Sabbath, that we reorient our holidays around the biblical festivals, right? That we reorient our calendar, our time, our our sense of well-being, our sense of community, the way our communities function around biblical models. And for the most part, that is simply not being done. The ramifications of what has been done for the last 2,000 years are staggering. Right? The way Western culture and pagan holidays and feasts have been woven into the culture of the church makes it apparent that much of this lesson regarding Abraham's call has been lost to many. Right? And of course, we need to consider to what extent these lessons have been lost on us. I mean, obviously, right? This is the Bible. This is God's Word. This is truth. This is inspired by the Spirit. This is inspired in a way that is intended to change us, right? I mean, even Paul talked about it in his letter to the Corinthians, right? Now I know in part, right? He says, when I was a child, I thought as a child. But at some point, we're supposed to grow up. We're supposed to mature. We're supposed to evolve, to develop, right? And to become what God has called us to be. Even though that is not something that we will experience in totality here, it's something that we have to strive to experience, right? Not only in our own lives, of course, but we have to strive to see this occur in the lives of others as well. Okay? I apologize for the time. There is much more that could obviously be said. I was hoping to get to the other comments and the notes, but I think you can probably discern the significance of them for yourselves. So with that, I'm going to close. Anybody, questions, comments?
You know, understanding what Abram did and how he made converts and Aram and so on and so forth and all that, and thinking about the aspects of idolatry, and you touched on some of that, and then I felt like even with your comments about the reality of the church and how the history of the church has woven so much idolatry into its own fabric, which, from my mind, it makes the church not connected to Israel in the fashion that was talked about today in your study. And I hear the discussion, and I was even involved in a discussion today about what is idolatry today. Is it only the people in India, you know, who worship elephant gods with six human hands, you know, and people who meditate before statues of Buddha and so on and so forth, you know, or as others say, I've said on some discussions in Messianic men's groups a couple of years ago, where real idolatry is only when it is idolatry that involves illicit sexual activity, and if it doesn't involve that, it's not really idolatry. And the conclusion I came to through all of that was that as a believer in the one God, the one true God, the God of Israel, that it's our job, if you see it, to be like Abraham and to win people to that one true God and to a desire to learn Torah And, you know, at whatever amount that they choose to learn, encourage them and empower them to accomplish it. And, you know, that's good enough. I mean, can you expound on that a little more, where your view is on that? And, I mean, am I sharing a similar view that you have, or do you care to expound on that some? That's all I guess I can really say halfway intelligently on the matter.
Very good. I'd be happy to talk about it. Idolatry in the Bible is defined far more broadly than sexual immorality. I mean, sexual immorality in biblical times was connected to idolatry, but to the extent that both men and women went to pagan temples and engaged in sexual intercourse with both male and female prostitutes, right? I mean, but what about the occasions in the scripture where the Lord condemns his people for allowing their children to go through the fire to Molech? That doesn't involve sexual immorality, but that's every bit as idolatrous. And of course, the scripture talks about the fact that they carved images and set up altars under groves of trees on high hills, right? That did not necessarily involve sexual immorality. It was a place where people could worship false gods, right? The gods of thunder, the gods of fertility, the gods of procreation, the gods of fill in the blank, because the pagans in biblical times had a god for virtually everything, right? Now, they may not have been defined as clearly, at least in terms of our understanding of them, as were the gods of the ancient Greeks and Romans. But the fact of the matter is that idolatry is anything that a person substitutes for God. And this substitution often includes practices. In other words, if a person, for example, substitutes money for God, right, then you can see an evidence of that substitution in their lives, right? They begin to act on the basis of what is good for them financially, exclusively, right? In other words, it becomes all about the money, not about doing what is or isn't right. Do you understand? Now, money happens to be an easy one to pick on, right? Because we see so much evidence of it in our own culture, right? But of course, there are many other examples we could give to or provide. And the fact of the matter is that when we trust in astrology, when we trust in a horoscope, when we trust in a superstitious behavior, right? We get into the World Series and make sure that we don't change our socks because we keep on the pair of socks and underwear that we won the first game of the series in. And so we wear the same things. Do you understand? I mean, these kinds of behaviors reflect an idolatrous way, because trusting in anything except for God to guide you, to lead you, to direct you, you know, if we consider other things besides God when it comes to making decisions about things, then, right, then we're off the mark. And obviously we're people, so we are sometimes off the mark. There isn't a single one of us alive you know, who doesn't make decisions selfishly from time to time or do things that are in our best interest. So I'm not suggesting that it's possible to completely, you know, shed, you know, our nature. But the story of Abraham, if it's about anything, it's about doing just that. It's about being conformed into the image of the Messiah. I mean, isn't that what really, that God really wants of us all? Right? You have a problem with Friday the 13th? You have a problem with walking under a ladder? If there isn't a pail of paint on one of the rungs of the ladder that might fall? I mean, do you understand? You have a problem if a black cat crosses your path? You know? I mean, you know, most of us who go to a Chinese restaurant, you know, are kind of amused, you know, by the fortune and the fortune cookie. But I have been to dinner with people who read that fortune and think to themselves, wow, God is speaking. You know, I mean, come on. Is that the way God guides his people? You know, I mean, it's hard to talk about because on the one hand, idolatry is so pervasive in our culture, right? I mean, it's like listening to a celebrity, for example, speak on a particular subject simply because they're a celebrity, not because they necessarily have any experience talking about whatever it is that they're discussing. Do you understand? Now, there are celebrities who are educated and do good things, and they use their celebrity status in order to attract attention to a cause. I don't have a problem with that. But the fact of the matter is that we tend to put celebrities on such a pedestal that we tend to think that what they say has merit. Not because they're speaking with any acquired wisdom, but because they're popular in movies. I mean, my God. You know, it's mind-boggling, frankly. I don't know if that answered the question, but if there are no other comments, then we'll call it an afternoon. Very good. Shabbat Shalom. So nice to see everybody. Wish we could all be together in the same place. That would be great. One day, Lord willing. So, God bless you guys.